This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Before we start our first conversation, we'd like to give you a heads up that while we won't be going into graphic detail, we'll be discussing the topic of suicide during the first half of today's show. If you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. And now, onto our program. Among industries, construction has one of the highest suicide rates, but unlike other professional fields with disproportionately high rates of suicide, like dentistry and veterinary medicine, the skilled trades offer little to no immediate care for workers who lose colleagues or loved ones in the same field of work to suicide. New research from a St. Louis labor advocate shows how postvention care could bring benefits and why peer support is the most effective way to provide that support. John Gall is behind that study, which is featured in the International Journal of Vocational Education and Training Summer 2026 edition. He's Chief Research Officer of Construction's Acute Suicide Postvention Response Project and Director of Worker Wellness for the Missouri Works Initiative. He's also Chief Learning Officer for the St. Louis Building Trades Wellness Coalition. And he joins us now. John, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Elaine. Proud to be here and just blessed that your station is willing to tackle a tough topic like this in August, which is great preparation for next month, September, which is pretty much worldwide Suicide Prevention Awareness Month.
So, John, I have just introduced you with a number of titles, and we've talked with you on past shows about peer support in this context of helping people who work in the trades who have substance misuse struggles. But there's another title to describe you that is at the heart of your personal experiences, and that is dad. So for those who are hearing you for the first time, tell us about that.
Certainly. So our family lost our oldest son, John Jr., age 24, on March the 24th of 2017 to suicide. He had been struggling as a result of multiple concussions from high school football and soccer. And this started my journey into trying to work through the grief and then hopefully help others learn, you know, the lessons I learned through that growth.
Thank you for sharing that again with us. Now, John, I understand that something you experienced with a colleague about 4 years after losing your own son that also connects directly to your current research.
Correct. So, Elaine, you can only imagine how that rests in the back of your mind. The question, you know, there's what a dear friend of mine and mentor, Dr. Frank Campbell, calls the canyon of why. You know, why did this happen? Why didn't I do more? All those kinds of issues. And so that why was always sitting in the back of my mind. And it was summer, you know, late summer of 21, 4 years later, as you mentioned. And our youngest daughter and my wife and I sat down to watch a movie on a Saturday night. Probably the first time we actually did that in 4 years of that in that kind of a context. Very relaxed atmosphere, and about 20 minutes into the movie, my phone just keeps blowing up, and I knew I had to take that call. Stepped out of the room, and it was a colleague, a dear friend of mine in the St. Louis area, who shared with me that his son had taken his life that day, and basically called me because he knew no one else who had lost a child to suicide, and asked me if I could just sit with him and talk. And that's what we did for the next hour. And I tried to share some tips, go back into that memory Rolodex of what did happen, what might have happened, and what worked, what didn't work, and told him I'd call him in 2 days and check up on him. And it was really enlightening to me that 2 days later, he took some of those bits of advice and worked with his children and his spouse and himself to seek help. So then I sat with that for a few more years. And then in the summer of 2024, from the middle of July to the middle of October, during those 12 weeks, I took 8 more of those types of calls. Most of those were industry related. All of them called me with almost the same explanation that the call I received in September of 21. Hey, I know you. You've been through this. Can you help me with this? So the interesting thing I surmised from that, none of those calls asked me, what do I do 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years from now? Every one of them was, I'm in the eye of the storm. Can you please help me? Mm-hmm. And so that's when I put my research hat back on, said, hey, it's time to stop thinking about this and start doing something about it. So I embarked upon a study.
What are one or two of the things that you said to those friends and colleagues in those hours, you know, within the day or so afterward?
Well, you want to check on them to make sure they and their loved ones are safe. And once you move from that, it helps to start asking some probing questions that are not personal, but more in the sense of what is it that you need from me? Mm-hmm. And often they just needed some direction because I put myself back in that space on March the 24th of 2017. I often use this to describe how it felt. It felt like someone took me out into the middle of the Lake of the Ozarks, dropped me off off the boat, and sped away. I didn't have anything other than treading water to keep myself above water. And then another boat comes up, and I think, oh, goodness, they're going to start throwing me life preservers. No, they start throwing me 100-pound sacks of potatoes. Mm. That's how I felt. So I wanted to try to make sure that there was hope and there was some help available. And what worked for me necessarily won't work for you. What works for you may not work for your spouse and children and so on and so forth. So I just tried to make sure they had an array of options. So options were key to me.
Mm-hmm. So this term postvention, is this something that, you know, that you came up with? How did you come upon it? And what did the research beginnings look like?
So in my opinion, I would say I came upon it more than 10 years ago. So even prior to us losing little John. As a matter of fact, I would say the whole effort in construction as far as safety goes and moving from just focusing on the physical aspects of safety to start to focus on the mental aspects of safety really went quickly from 2004 to 2007, because when WashU School of Medicine researchers came to us, they wanted to speak about the physical aspects of safety in 2004. But when 07 rolled around through 11, we were in the depths of the global economic crisis. And I could see that wearing on our apprentices. And I went back and approached them, said, hey, look at this. I think you're only studying part of the human, and we need to study the full human. And part of that experience is the mental aspects of safety as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what moved us in that direction. And then you, of course, know from previous shows that a dear friend of mine, Don Willie, lost his son to an opioid overdose in March of 2016. So that further ingrained our efforts to start being more proactive as opposed to being reactive. We started moving in that direction with the researchers. which made life a lot easier because they would do the study and produce the results, and then we could speak, you know, from a scientific standpoint, as opposed to Don and my standpoint was always looked upon often as too emotional. But now we had the science to back the emotions.
Too emotional.
That's correct.
In dealing with something that is as impactful as losing someone to suicide, with post-intervention support, how do you think that your own experience and the experience of your wife and your daughter would have been different?
Well, it would have been very helpful in those first 24 to 48 hours to turn to a program, an agency, or what have you, to do basically what I was doing for those nine different calls that I was receiving. I was just like in a forest without any compass or any, you know, light in the middle of the night. And so just having those options, those resources, because, again, it's very important to understand, even though John's older sister, Dana, and his little brother, Jake, and his little sister, Leah, mm-hmm. knew him, and it was part of, you know, they were siblings. Each one of them knew him differently. And so each one of them need to be approached, you know, differently, so that we can't just come up with a rigid framework and says, here, apply this. We have to use that as kind of a guide, you know, some guardrails, and then guide people towards the available programs that are available to help people work through not just the acute phase, but the phases that follow that, you know, the grief work, and then after that, the post-traumatic growth piece.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand, you know, knowledge about what was happening and why, you and your wife were separated by first responders that night?
That is correct.
I mean, what was going through your mind at that time? I mean, how did you and your wife talk about it afterward?
Well, this is part of the learning process. So, you know, when you're able to step back and reflect, now that it's been, you know, over 9 years, I get it. At that moment, I certainly did not, because we had just lost our son, and we needed to be together to support one another. But you said earlier, you know, how did I come upon postvention? Well, because I was already 10 years ago in the, you know, the suicide prevention and intervention spaces. I had earned training credentials and was delivering that type of training. But I was not aware of anything specific to postvention, what we call the aftercare. And then I started to participate in some ECHO programs out of Mizzou. And they had a speaker on there. I mentioned his name, Dr. Frank Campbell. Mm-hmm. So I would consider him the godfather of postvention. But he studied under Dr. Edwin Schneidman, and he would probably be considered the grandfather of postvention. So these are things that opened doors for me to look into it and try to understand why we needed to do more. I knew people who were on the Missouri Suicide Prevention Network out of Jeff City, and I had asked them about, were they going to do anything in the postvention space? And in late 24, they reached out to me and said, we just redid our strategic plan, and part of that was in our top 10 goals was to start addressing the postvention issue. They created a committee. I was placed on that committee and very blessed to be a part of that. So we're moving it in a statewide manner as well.
We need to take a quick break here, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation about new research that points to postvention and peer support as ways to address disproportionately high rates of suicide in the construction industry. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Thank you. Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with St. Louisan John Gall. He's the Chief Research Officer of the Construction's Acute Suicide Prevention Postvention Response, and his latest study on suicide postvention in the construction industry appears in the latest edition of the International Journal of Vocational Education and Training's Journal. So before the break, we were talking about, you know, how you got into this research regarding postvention. And one of the things that stood out to me is the scope. So your findings have been published in an international journal, and I understand that a professional journal in Canada asked to publish your findings as well. Why did you decide to talk with people in other countries, and how willing were they to speak with you?
That's a great question. So I was engaged in learning about as much as I could about prevention, intervention, and now postvention. And a doctoral student by the name of Dr. Susie Bennett did a international webinar early one morning in late 22, I believe it was. And it was on why men die by suicide. And she's from Scotland. And I thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. I think I'm going to listen to that and be part of that, because maybe in Scotland, men die by suicide for other reasons than they do here in the United States. And that became a budding relationship. And when I reached out to her, telling her that I was going to research on postvention, she said that, you know, her work has always been in prevention, so she'll give me Dr. John Gibson out of Scotland and Dr. John Whitebrook out of England to speak to about their work in the postvention arena. And so this just kind of kept snowballing. Every time you talk to somebody else, you would find, you know, someone else that could help you out. So, you know, in the construction industry in the United States, we're losing about 5,000 workers on an annual basis to suicide. And if you just break that down, that is one person every 2 hours every day of the year. So we're not taking weekends off. It's 365 days a year. And when you look at the overall data when it comes to suicide, in the United States, 18% of the suicide deaths are directly related to the construction industry, and yet they only make up about 7% of the workforce. We have a crisis here. Mm-hmm. It wasn't personal; it was professional as well.
Yeah. When we talk about suicide survivors, John, what do we mean, and is that typically expansive enough?
Well, that, I would say, is something that I think everyone needs to define on their own. And the reason being is, technically, if you go back 15 or so years ago and you looked at the data back then, many of the experts were claiming that one suicide impacted about six people around the person who died. Thank goodness to research out of the University of Kentucky in 2018, that actually is closer to 135. And so that could be family members, friends, coworkers. So the importance of postvention in what I call the first 48 hours, what I really mean is, you know, between 24 and 72 hours, but it just sounds much better by, you know, putting into the first 48 context. It's very important that we step in and provide support. And reason we need to provide support is because on the job site, if there are 135 workers, the peers have to be trained to deal with 135 different means of providing that support. It's not one size fits all. And I think this is so very important in how we approach this topic.
Mm-hmm. When you were doing this research, which involved surveys, what were the questions that you wanted to answer?
Yeah. So I would say the three main questions were: should the U.S. construction industry address the aftermath of suicides? And so my study was a mixed methods. It had multiple stages. The first stage was surveys. Mm-hmm. We had 64 people from across five nations participate. 95% of the responses agreed that we needed to do something. In the interviews, we went to 15 different people, not part of that 64, mm-hmm. and this being a pilot study, we interviewed those individuals, and 100% of them indicated that, yes, the U.S. construction industry needs to move forward on this topic. So if they answered in the affirmative there, then we went to the question two, and that was, is there a need for a postvention program that focuses on the acute phase? So the acute phase, again, is that first 24 to 72. I just condensed it into the first 48. From the surveys, 77% of the responses agreed with that, and 73% of the responses in the interviewees. And then if you had answered affirmatively there, we moved on to question three, and that is, if so, might a peer support model best serve this need? And 81% of the surveyees said yes, while almost 50% of the interviewees said yes. And in the interview phase, I brought in two other researchers to help me to analyze the data and find the themes, pick out the real meaty responses. And the one real meaty response on this came from a licensed practitioner who said, what's important here is peers, because they're the first line of defense and they can do so much better than a professional. And a lot of that, you know, as I get further and further into this, talking to more people, construction is still about 89% male. So there's a macho culture and they're not always ready to let down their guard, especially in a peer-to-professional differential. But when it's a peer-to-peer on the same level, that they're more willing to let down their guard.
Mm-hmm. In this context of postvention, John, why is peer support something that you see benefiting workers and helping employers, that side of things? You know, would that approach be more effective than support from therapists and psychiatrists?
So I do want to make it clear that I'm not trying to cut out the licensed professionals by any stretch of the imagination. They have a part to play. But the fact is, in previous research that I've done with regards to mental health in the construction industry in both the United States and Canada, 0% of the participants of that pilot study indicated that they would use their EAP or MAP, mm-hmm. meaning an employee assistance plan. And on the union side, we refer to it as a member assistance plan. So if we're not using services that are available to them, we have to move in a different direction, because we already established the culture doesn't really move towards using professional help. So how do we find and skill up and properly train peers to step into this? And you well know, because you've done more than one show on the LEAN program with the laborers here in St. Louis, they have done some fabulous work. They have set the tone in the industry that other unions are now coming on board. So we've got the elevator constructors, we got the plumbers and pipe fitters, the bricklayers, the electricians, and I could go on and on and on, the iron workers and so on and so forth. But what was made clear in both the surveys and the interviews, that these people have to be properly trained. As you can imagine, there are often a lot of willing people to help other people, but sometimes they do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing. So we've taken two steps forward, and maybe from an ethical and legal standpoint, we possibly would take 10 steps backwards. So we are huge supporters of the state of Missouri has a Missouri credentialing board that has a proper certification program for peer specialists. And we really, you know, try to move our peers who volunteer to take this position to move in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would also imagine then for those peers who are providing that support, that they need support themselves too, right?
That's correct. So, so to that end, I would suggest that because the laborers program, their LEAN program for peer support has been so successful, they were, James and Aaron, you know, the two people that are hitting the ground every day on this, they are getting calls not only from other trades, Elaine, but from other cities and states. Mm-hmm. So that's when we realized that we need to do something more and be more proactive here in St. Louis. So instead of each trade reinventing the wheel, we came together and we created what we call the St. Louis Building Trades Wellness Coalition. And so that actually offers an array of services. We do quarterly meetings where we bring labor and management and other interested folks in the room and discuss a lot of these tough topics like this, like substance misuse, like gambling addiction and things of that nature. And then we find providers who can help become part of our team. So we're moving in a direction that truly takes both labor and management to engage in. And that's one of the blessings that we have here in the St. Louis area. Both labor and management in the union sector have a long history of working hand in glove with one another. And we were really blessed in this space of the postvention because I looked at six models around the world to try to find one that would work for construction. And the one I kept coming back to was the TAPS program. It's a military-based model. Mm-hmm. It's been around for a number of years. And but it took money, funding to do that. And once again, labor and management stepped up and did the right thing. So the laborers, their trust fund, as well as their local union here, Local 42, as well as their international from Springfield, Illinois, they stepped up, as well as one of our union electrical contractors, Guarantee Electrical. They stepped up and provided the funding to do a three-day intensive training to really move this ball down the field. And so they came and did that just at the end of April of this year.
John, you've been very busy lately. You've led some seminars and presentations about these findings of your research over the last month and a half. Some have been to skilled trades-related agencies, to mental health and construction professionals, and to the general public. What has the response been so far?
It's been really receptive. It's very interesting to have people in the room, and these are familiar faces, and some of them say, you know, they shout out in the middle of the presentation, I've never even heard the term postvention. Mm-hmm. So it's a great learning experience. And again, I think when we have personal stories to tie into the topic, it tends to be very productive, and it's been so far in both the professional setting and the public settings.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that this was a pilot study. So what is ahead when it comes to doing further research? Are there certain partners that you're looking for, specific groups that you'd like to work with?
Yes. So to this end, I really think we need to move beyond just labor and management and get the owners, the buyers of construction involved. Because they're the ones who create the contract documents for a building to be built. And, you know, if they are serious and dedicated to suicide prevention, intervention, and postvention, let's put it in the contract documents. Some big projects over the last 5 years have been doing this. Mm-hmm. And so I would just like to encourage the big players here in St. Louis to take a look at that as well.
Mm-hmm. Should they get in touch with you? Who can they be in contact with?
That would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. one of the ways to get in touch with me would be through the new launch, the newly launched website for this project, and it's c-a-s-p-r.us. So it's casper.us, and you'll find plenty of information about Postvention and some of the projects we have going on and some of the events we have coming up, as well as an opportunity to send us a request for information. So please let us know.
John Gall is the Chief Research Officer of the Construction's Acute Suicide Postvention Response Project. His latest study on suicide postvention in the construction industry is featured in the latest edition of the International Journal of Vocational Education and Training. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. Again, it's been a pleasure and an honor.
And please remember, if you or someone you know is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.
This episode was produced by Emily Woodbury.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.